Imagine a school day built around your child's needs and interests. It's possible with K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited, tuition-free, online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn from state-certified teachers trained to teach online. And with the flexibility to learn wherever there's internet, it can fit into any family schedule. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. You can make the switch at any time. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Jennifer Cahill, who has over 17 years' experience in personal development. In her novel, One, you can follow the escapades of a group of 20-something singletons as they search for love, self-awareness and satisfaction in the city of London in the mid-noughties. The book was very much inspired by Jennifer's own experiences of her 20s living in Clapham. Sue Knight is also with us. She's an accomplished poet and dystopian short fiction writer. Her first full-length novel, Waiting for Gordo, is billed as an eco-thriller set in the Maldives. The book gives a vivid portrayal of the idyllic world of a remote island set up to cater for dive tourists, but underlying this utopia is foreboding that grows to terror. We also have Christopher Bardsley, who lives and works in Melbourne, Australia. He teaches literature and history and has just published his debut novel, Jack Was Here. It's a suspenseful, atmospheric thriller about a traumatized ex-soldier who's tasked with finding a backpacker who has mysteriously disappeared from the beaches of southern Thailand. And finally, Ali Carter read art history at St Andrews and has followed her passion to become a fine artist. Her first novel, A Brush with Death, is the first in a new series introducing pet portraitist and amateur super sleuth Susie Mull. It's described as Agatha Christie meets Downton Abbey. That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can let it in. No one else can speak the words on your lips. Drink yourself in words unspoken, live your life.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Jennifer L. Cahill, who works both with individuals and blue chip clients to help them navigate and master change and transformation. She has over 17 years in personal development. She's with us on the book show to talk about her novel One. In it, you can follow the escapades of a group of 20-something singletons as they search for love, self-awareness and satisfaction in the city of London. Welcome to the book show, Jennifer.
Hi, Hannah. Thanks for having me on the show.
Pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. And is this your first book?
It is, absolutely, yes. Debut, first book. Very excited about it.
Fantastic. I understand that it was very much inspired by your own 20s living in Clapham.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in Ireland and I was educated there. And when I landed in London, I was very fortunate to sort of arrive to Clapham, not knowing what it was going to be like. And I still think, you know, even looking back now, I think it's the best place in the world to live if you're in your 20s, because it's full of 20-somethings and everyone's sort of up for a laugh. And the way Clapham's even structured around Clapham Common, there's just so much to do there. also you sort of find that when you live there, you kind of don't leave there at the weekends because there's so much going on. So, and I think some of the interesting characters that it attracts as well really makes life very interesting.
Yeah. So when were you there?
In the noughties, basically. Nearly all of the noughties. So the book is based in the mid-noughties. And it's really interesting because I wrote it years ago and I simply didn't have time to bring it out. And I think the timing, some of the issues that I deal with in the book, the timing is really good now because some of the equality movements and women's movements have reached critical mass. Whereas if I had published it years ago, it would have been a bit interesting, but I don't think as many people were there, because I look at sort of relationships in the modern world and how the relationship models are changing. And it's really interesting. One of the things I wanted to cover in the book was, I want to cover how technology is changing, you know, the world we live in. And this is just before Twitter, Facebook, Wi-Fi everywhere. So it was really interesting looking back at the book because it's like a time capsule of just before all of that happened.
So it's
really interesting in that way, because some of the things that happen in the book, if say someone who's 25 now is reading it, they're just like, how is that possible? You know, because in the modern world, you know, with Facebook stalking and all that kind of stuff, in a lighthearted way, not scary Facebook stalking, but she would have sort of found out things and there wouldn't have been the misunderstanding that occurs in the book.
It's interesting how much technology, social media, things like that has changed the world we make friends and date, I guess.
Yeah. And it's not just that, it's leveled the playing field. It's made the world more meritocratic. So the role of, if you take women, for example, it's not a feminist book. It's more about equality. But, you know, there's no kind of limitations on women. There's a couple of girls who set up a business about the glam clam. And it's some kind of makeup bag that's in the shape of a clam. It looks really cool. And, you know, they're really young, they're really successful. And because of the online presence that they have, their business has soared, you know, and that's just a good example of how the playing field has been leveled and women, you know, are really successful now as men. And I think a lot of that is to do with technology because, you know, people can sell stuff online. There's also a huge YouTube presence now of, you know, makeup artists and bloggers, and they didn't have to depend on anyone to get an online audience. They're just really good at what they do and spend the time doing it. So I just think that's really interesting. And the book is set just before all of that started happening and reaching critical mass. So it's really interesting to look back.
Yeah. So tell us about some of your characters then. Let's hear about Zara.
Yes. Okay, so obviously as a writer, you know, some of my experiences will have inspired me to write. It is fiction, it's not about me, but some of the people I've met along the way and some of the experiences I've had. I have quite a long career in consulting, so I move industry all the time, so I do get visibility of different industries and how they work. Penelope is one of the main characters, and she's 28, and she's got the pressure on from her mum to be settled down by the time she's 30, which in the modern world, I think that's quite ridiculous. I think we're all living much longer now. You know, before in a more traditional relationship model, maybe 30 was, you know, a great benchmark. But I just think in the modern world, the way things are going, that's ridiculous. So poor Penelope has this pressure on her. She's also an only child, so her mum has been planning her wedding, you know, since her own wedding, basically. no pressure.
Help!
Yeah, absolutely. God, it makes me shudder. And Penelope works in an investment bank. She's got an amazing career, and her mum can't really relate to that because she doesn't understand the ins and outs of the pressure that Penelope's under. Penelope works in quite a male-dominated environment as well. So that's another thing that I sort of cover in the book. She wants to meet the one, of course, but she spends so much time in work that she doesn't have much time to meet people outside of her working environment. So she ends up going out with bankers all the time, and it's not really fulfilling her. And we see Penelope's journey through this throughout the book and the different sort of characters she meets along the way. And then that's juxtaposed with Zara, who has just moved to London from a kind of very small town and is just like finding her feet. And there's no instruction manual and no one, you know, everyone's rushing around doing their own thing. So we see the two different characters develop in different ways. And I do think that London is, you know, can be a tough city, but I think it's a sink or swim situation, and I think if you make it in London, I think it can be the most amazing city in the world in terms of professional life and social life and so on. And then we have the male characters. So we have Richard Lord, who is from an aristocratic family in Scotland. We've got Alix, who is half French, half Scottish and gorgeous. And he's a bit of an international man of mystery. And then we have Charlie, who's a Trustafarian musician. So you can see the sort of variety of characters in the book and then how their relationships develop and move along through the story. And another character in the book is definitely London. So, you know, I try to bring sort of the essence of a place and time to life. So Clapham in London, I try to bring that to life for people in terms of, you know, what it's like to live there and that kind of thing.
Would you go back?
To Clapham?
Mm.
In a heartbeat, yeah. I'd love to be able to transport back to my 20s as well. So, if only. I do go back a bit because I still have some friends there. I felt like I outgrew it, so I was there for a good nearly 10 years. I'm not 20-something or a yummy mummy, so it was time to move to Notting Hill, which I love as well. But Clapham is fantastic. But it evolves as well. So my book is based in Clapham in sort of the mid-noughties. But if I lived in Clapham now, I'm sure it would be very different then. It moves with the times because it's a lot of young people, 20-somethings and so on, and they just bring their energy with them and bring, you know, how they live with them. I still think it's amazing. And I do think the common is really part of that because everyone sort of congregates in the summer on the common, sunbathing and so on. And it's like an open-air resort. We call it Costa del Clapham. And a few other people, that's in the book, but a few other people have actually said that to me. So apparently that's how people do talk about it. So, yeah, I just think it's fantastic. You know, it's kind of work hard, play hard sort of place.
I bet a lot of people can relate to a particular time in their 20s, I guess, for a lot of people, where they were at the time, you know, if they were at university or college or traveling maybe, and kind of see it as some of the best times of their lives. And it's interesting to imagine being back there 10, 20, 30 years later and thinking the reality is it was all potentially about the people and the age that you were.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you think I came from Ireland, which we all live quite suburbanly in Ireland, you know, and then I moved to Clapham and you had one of the best bars in the city at the end of the driveway. I mean, to me that was just absolutely extraordinary, and I just thought it was amazing. And then the type of people that I met along the way and the type of people my friends met and went out with and stuff, just very interesting. And because London's such a big city, you meet the most amazing people who have these incredible backgrounds, like Richard's an aristocrat, Alix, well, I'll leave it to the readers to find out what he's like, but he's just extraordinary as well. And then Charlie is totally different. I've purposely had three different types of guys in the book. And I say purposely, I mean, writing is an organic process. It just flows. And of course, once you then reread, you go, oh, yes, that makes sense. But it's just a natural process. So the characters just sort of formed in my mind as I started writing. And then it just went from there, basically.
And when you started writing, did you have a clear idea of where you were going with the book and the story, or did that happen as you were writing?
That's a really good question, because that happened as I was writing. So what I basically did was I literally sat down and started writing about Clapham. That's all. I just went, okay, you know, I just SW4, bang, started writing. And the minute I sat down at the laptop, it just started flowing. It was an amazing process, because I don't know if you can sit there and fully plan a book and then you go on the journey with it. There's a couple of potential endings, what's going to happen. And it takes time, though. You have to give it the time to sort of for the ideas to germinate and you test a few things. But it wasn't fully planned from the beginning. But then once it started flowing, the story started flowing quite nicely.
Mm. And are you happy with how it's turned out?
Yes, I am. I mean, I think as a debut, I'll be very interested to hear how the readers react to it, because I really did write it for them. I had the readers in mind the whole time, and I just thought, first of all, that my beliefs are coming through in this kind of conversation. You know, I think Clapham's an amazing place to live. I think London's an amazing city. I mean, if you're going to meet the one, you're probably going to meet him or her here in London, you know, where the variety is better. I think, you know, relationship models are shifting and changing as we live in one of the most innovative periods in living history. And I think that I did write it for the readers, because I just thought, God, if I can give something, someone, a reader, a book to sort of read on the tube to just take themselves out of their normal commute for 10, 15 minutes in the morning. I just thought that would be great. And I hope I make people laugh as well, because some of the things that happen are just quite funny. And I think you have to have a bit of a sense of humour to cope with the ups and downs of life, basically.
And dare I ask, have you met the one?
Everyone's going to ask me that. So I'm actually writing about my journey. No, I know. It's the first question everyone's going to ask me. The first thing I would say is it is fiction. It's not me in the story, but my experiences have inspired the story. I would say that in terms of finding the one, I've gone about it the long way around. So I've had lots of challenges. And to be honest with you, I wouldn't have a story if I'd met someone when I was 22 and lived happily ever after. Mm. So I think that I'm also writing about my experience as well. So I don't want to kind of give away too much about my own journey yet, because I'm writing about it.
Okay, fair enough.
But that, yeah, but just trust me, I went about it the long way. And I had challenges like being a professional person, spending a lot of time in work, and that was all kind of new back then, you know. So, so it's been an interesting journey, and I put little nuggets in the book of stuff that I've learned along the way. So I'm really hoping that they can help people get there a bit quicker, because we're all so busy these days. No one has time to sit there and go, how do you find the one, and how would you do? And so I've put some stuff and I put some scenarios in the book, which I hope help people. Because I am a chain specialist after all, so we live in a very ever-changing world. So I think that I've laid out some scenarios and some nuggets about the one. And I think attitude is very important as well. I think people thinking, I have to be married by the time I'm 30. That's ridiculous. You mightn't have met him by then or her by then. So I think I've put some stuff like that in the books, which will hopefully help people.
Yeah, it's interesting how people can have an opinion of how easy it is or not to find love in somewhere like London, based, I guess, on their own experiences. You know, I've got friends who have had very different experiences, some of which have got really good jobs, who work long hours, as you say, earn lots of money and have just no time for a social life at all.
Yeah.
And others who have jobs that they love but aren't earning as much money and have more time for social life but can't afford it.
Yeah.
So it's
exactly.
There's lots of different ways.
There's lots of different scenarios, and I think in a city as big as London, where you have all these different types of jobs and so many young people, you do see that. And I think it can be challenging. You know, ironically, in a city of 8 million people, you know, it should be easy to find the one, but it can be more challenging if you never see the light of day. And poor Penelope, I mean, not only is she in work for a lot of her time or every waking hour, because that's what's required here. She's not a workaholic, it's what's required. She's also in an all-male environment, more or less, and so the only people she meets are people in her work industry, which isn't really what she wants, I don't think,
no.
But I'll let the readers decide about that. But yeah, so hopefully a few nuggets will come through, and as people read it, they'll be like, oh, that makes sense, and oh yeah, maybe I should shift my attitude, and oh, maybe I don't need to get married by the time I'm 30. Yeah. And it all depends on sort of the age of the person reading. I think someone reading it who's 20-something might get that really quickly, although I think they'll think the lack of technology is quite weird.
Yeah,
what do you mean, bringing your landline? Yeah.
Exactly.
But but hopefully they'll go on the journey all the same.
Yeah. Well, if people want to find out more about you as an author, they can have a look on your website, jenniferlcahill.com, and they can get a copy of your book. It's called One, and it'll be available to buy on our website in the TRE bookshop section. Jennifer, thanks very much for joining us, and best of luck with the book.
Great. Thanks so much, Hannah. Great to speak to you.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. TRE, Talk Radio Europe. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Sue Knight. She is already an accomplished poet and dystopian short fiction writer, but she's with us on the book show to talk about her first full-length novel. It's called Waiting for Gordo. It's billed as an eco-thriller and is set in the Maldives. The book explores eco-destruction, responsibility, and the darkness that so often underlies the beauties of nature. Welcome to the book show, Sue.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us. Initially, I thought, oh, set in the Maldives, how lovely, but it's not all lovely, is it?
Well, no, I hope though it's both interesting and funny. I've tried to make it a page turner, But yes, it's about a dive holiday that goes horribly wrong on a beautiful paradise island.
How many times have you been to the Maldives?
Do you know, I was trying to count up and I can't. We were expatriates for 25 years. We worked in the Middle East. And my husband is a scuba diver. And for many years, he took a party of divers to the Maldive Islands every year. And usually I used to go with them. No, I'm not a diver myself. So I've been many times, but I've actually lost count.
Oh, how lovely.
It was so beautiful. Yeah, and it was a wonderful life, actually. The beauty of the islands really inspired me. They are sort of the perfect paradise tropical island.
I was going to say, how would you describe them? Because looking at photos on the internet, it really does look like a paradise, as you say.
Well, they are. I mean, it's very, very hot because you're sort of sitting on the equator there, more or less. When you fly over them, you see them in the ocean. They're atolls and lagoons. They're like little jewels in the ocean, a turquoise ocean. The islands don't have any cars on them, so there's no traffic noise. The nights are beautifully quiet with very bright stars. You just hear the waves beating at the island's edge. They are lovely, but of course, nothing is paradise at the moment, so they aren't paradise any more than anywhere else is, which does come out in the book.
Yes, where did this negative side come from then about the Maldives? What did you discover?
Well, it's nothing about the Maldives, but really what I was thinking about is the way the kind of, I suppose, the tensions of tourism. You know, we find a beautiful unspoiled spot, then we all pile in. And do we spoil it by piling it, by piling in like that? But on the other hand, we're also needed. They have a very important tourist industry there. It is their main industry, I believe. So it's not really about the Maldives as such. Oh, and it's also about the way that nowhere actually is paradise at the moment. Everything, there's always tensions wherever you are.
So what do you mean about the eco side of things, the eco-destruction?
Well, just the weight that's put on the islands by what we have, what we expect as tourists. I mean, when my husband first went there, the accommodation, many years ago, the accommodation was pretty basic. The food was pretty basic too. It was fish from the ocean, rice, coconuts. But now, as tourists, you know, we expect a sort of a full buffet. I do dwell on that quite a bit in the book. You know, we expect kind of everything, and we expect a high standard of accommodation. And I understand, I'm not an eco-specialist, but I understand it puts quite a lot of pressure on the fragile structure of the islands. There was an interesting article on the news today about how the tides are having to close one of the popular paradise beaches. I think the one that featured in that movie, The Beach, because the weight of tourism is just wrecking the ecology there.
Gosh, how awful. That's terrible.
Yes, it's very difficult. Nobody seems to have the answer to it.
Mm.
I think they cope as well in the Maldives as anywhere else. I mean, the water's is beautifully clean. The fish and the corals are wonderful. Although we did live through a bit of an eco-tragedy there. It was the year of El Niño, 1997, when the temperatures of the water rose so high, just for a day or two, that it killed off the coral.
Oh, really? What, the, yes. All of it?
Yes, when we went there, the reefs were bleached. It was extraordinary. Of course, they're recovering in a slightly different way, but that was nothing to do with tourists or tourism. It was the forces of nature, you know.
Gosh, I remember when I was in Australia many years ago and did a bit of diving in the Great Barrier Reef, and everybody was told to be so, so careful, you know, not to touch it and not to break it and, you know, be really careful of the coral.
Yes, that is the rule for divers. You don't want to go touching the coral. You don't want to go damaging it. And the other thing is, if you put your hands on the coral, you can never be sure what you're putting your hand on.
Yeah, it can cut you as well, can't it? It can be very sharp.
Or it can give you a very nasty bite.
Yes, it's deceiving, beautifully deceiving.
That's right. That's what I mean by, in a way, it's not paradise at the moment. It looks so beautiful, but you've got to be careful.
Yes. So tell me about some of the characters in the book.
Well, I'm in it really as Miranda. She is me. I put my husband in. I don't think he can see me. I see him, her husband. But I have had to be very careful not to base any of the characters on anybody else, because my original thought was they were all going to be murdered one by one in some mysterious way.
Gosh.
But in the end, I couldn't do that. They all start to disappear one by one.
Okay. Okay, and this is this all set on the same trip? How long does the story last? Does it go over?
It's just a week. It's just a week, and it's a party of expat divers, Brits and Americans. They're going off for their annual dive holiday, as they always do, but this one, it just goes wrong.
So you'll say that Miranda's based on you and Jim's based on your husband. Are you talking about things that actually happened, or is it more personalities based on you?
More the personality. So I say Jim is based on my husband because I once caught him reading a book on our flight. We used to fly over very cheap airlines that were quite rickety, and I caught him reading a book called Great Airline Disasters of the World, which interested me flew across. So I've put that aspect of his character into the book and his love of diving.
I can't believe you'd read a book about plane disasters whilst being on a plane.
I know.
My goodness. So he's obviously fearless, your husband, then.
He's not a worrier, whereas I am. So I have that as the character in the book, that one of us is a worrier, one isn't.
Yeah.
It's not all that character-based. So I hope you get to know the characters, you know, enough to worry about them.
Mm.
So, or wonder about what's happened to them or what's happening to them.
Yeah. So people should like Miranda and Jim.
I hope so, yes. Yes, I hope so, yeah.
Otherwise you can take it personally if they don't.
Yeah, that's right.
So how long have you been working on the book for?
Oh, many years. I started it in my expat life, and we've now been retired for 10 years. But it took me a long time. I mean, I finished it quite a while ago. It took me a long time to find a publisher.
Mm.
It's not easy now if you don't have connections in the industry, I don't think.
No, can be very difficult. So did you get an agent first, or?
No, what I did is I sent off a short story to Fantastic Books. They were publishing an anthology, and those anthologies usually have a long short story in them. And I had one that I'd written about the last shopper left alive, because I was a bit worried about the way we seem to be covering the earth with shopping malls, and I thought we might run out of shoppers. And I wrote a story about it years ago, and I thought, you know, this is more topical than it was when I wrote it, so I think I'll send it off.
Mm.
And he didn't put it in the anthology, but to my surprise, he published it as a separate story, a separate little entity. So that gave me the confidence to send off the novel, and yes, he took it and he published it.
Oh, fantastic. Well done, you. And how did it compare writing a full-length novel to writing the short stories?
They both took me a long time. I'm a very slow writer in that I keep revising and revising, and I never know where I'm going when I start. And the problem with that is that when you realise halfway through what's happening, you have to go back and revise in line with that, because it doesn't always fit.
Mm. So you can change direction quite a lot.
Yeah, well, it's more that, for instance, when I started writing Waiting for Gordo, I didn't know why they were disappearing, who the villain was. I didn't know till halfway through. So then I had to kind of make sure that what I now knew was in line with what happened in the first half of the book, if you see what I mean.
Right, yeah. That's why editing is so important.
It is. I think edit, rewrite, and usually cut, and cut again is a good rule.
Yeah. So do you think there could be more books from you? Could there be more on these characters, do you think?
Well, people have asked me if there could be more on the characters in Waiting for Gordo. People have read it. I haven't thought so, but you never know. But I am working on another book I started in my expat life, which is about the two homes of my childhood, my parents' home and my granny's home, but it's written as a thriller. And I've borrowed the plot of Rebecca, which is the second wife haunted by thoughts of the first wife who's died.
Okay.
I have a Mrs. Danvers figure in it, but it's not Rebecca. It goes somewhere else. But so that's nearly finished now.
And are you enjoying that one as much?
Oh, I am. I'd love to get it finished. But once again, I've got the same problem, only worse, because it's it's not exactly a detective thriller, but more of a murder mystery in a way. I didn't know who the murderer was, once again, till halfway through. And I've given myself some difficult time jumps and some difficulties, so I'm just trying to iron them out.
Yes. Oh, great. Well, can you just explain before we say goodbye what waiting for Gordo means? Who or what is Gordo?
Oh, right. Well, Gordo is a diver that they're waiting for, who never arrives at the island, or does he? Now, the book was originally called Small Island, but by the time I came to get a publisher, I think it was Andrea Levy had had a brilliant success with a book called Small Island. So I thought I wouldn't use that title. And I remembered when I was young, in my uni days, the play Waiting for Godot was very popular.
Absolutely.
So I thought I'd do a little take on that, as I have this diver called Gordo who they're waiting for.
Oh, very clever. No, I like it. Well, if people want to get a copy of Waiting for Gordo, it's out now and available to buy in the TRE bookshop section on our website. And it's by Sue Knight, who we've been chatting to. Sue, thank you very much for joining us and best of luck with the book.
Thank you so much, Hannah. I do appreciate it.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from Melbourne, Australia, is Christopher Barsley, who lives and works there. In 2012, he was the recipient of the Above Water Prize for Fiction. His interests include modern and ancient history, with a particular focus on interpreting extremism. He's with us on the book show to talk about his first novel. It's called Jack Was Here. It's a suspenseful, atmospheric thriller about a traumatised ex-soldier who's tasked with finding a backpacker who's mysteriously disappeared from the beaches of southern Thailand. Welcome to the book show, Christopher.
Thank you, and thank you for having me, Anna.
Pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. And an interesting subject you've chosen, and sadly something that, well, on the outset doesn't sound too far-fetched.
No, it's actually a surprisingly common scenario, unfortunately. I've spent quite a bit of time in that part of the world over the years. I suppose if you added up all the time that I've spent in Thailand and Cambodia, you'd equal more than a year. And I've seen plenty of young people get unstuck, unfortunately, and come to sticky ends in the tropics.
Yeah, why do you think that is, and what do you mean by unstuck?
Well, I think that young people particularly, and I suppose that I was in this boat myself when I first went over there at the age of 19, get to Thailand and get to Cambodia and sort of think that a different set of rules applies over there. And it's sort of easy to fall into that trap. Thailand, Cambodia, they're beautiful, fantastic places, but they're very peculiar places. And it can be very easy to assume that you can get away with anything when you're there, which is absolutely not the case. And you see time and time again, people sort of, as I said, coming to untidy ends and getting into very serious trouble very quickly.
Yeah, the punishment can be a lot harsher there, can't it?
Yeah, the punishments can be a lot harsher there. It's also, I think, that it can be a little bit more difficult to sense when you're very close to very serious trouble. That's sort of something that I've seen quite a few times, and you really need to get a lay of the land to understand where the danger lies. And I think when you first arrive in Thailand or in Cambodia, you're having so much fun and it's so beautiful and slightly hedonistic, so it's easy to assume that nothing bad could happen, but it does happen.
Yeah. So tell us about your main character, Hugh.
Well, Hugh is a former Australian soldier. He spent some time in the military when he was young. He fought in Afghanistan. His experiences in Afghanistan came to an end when he was blown up by an IED and got honourably discharged with an injury from the military. And the plot picks him up about 5 or 6 years after that event. His life has faltered, I would say, in the aftermath of that traumatic event. And he's sort of a traumatized, dysfunctional protagonist. Some might say that he's something of an anti-hero. And he's picked up sort of, the narrative picks him up at a point where he's really exasperated and has given up on life in many ways.
And how about Jack?
Well, Jack is the person that he's tasked with going and finding. So Jack is a 19-year-old who's headed off to Asia on a backpacking trip after graduating from school. And, you know, this is a well-worn route in the aftermath of the schooling years here in Australia. A lot of people go over to Asia at that age, and he's gone off to enjoy this trip and has unfortunately just disappeared. And his parents have gone through all of the usual routes to try and find him. They've contacted the police in Thailand, the embassy. They've even hired a private investigator in Thailand to attempt to recover him. But they've just found absolutely nothing. And so what they do is they reach out to Hugh, who's a family friend, and they say, we'll give you $10,000 to go over there and attempt to recover him, and we'll give you another $10,000 if you find him. And what you need to do is basically whatever it takes. No questions asked.
Wow. It must be just awful for parents when their child goes missing at all, of course, but if in a foreign country, when they don't speak the language, even more barriers to stop you from being able to make contact.
Yeah, certainly. I think perhaps one of the things that inspired this book was when I was in a guest house in Cambodia and I saw a flyer on the wall there with a picture of a young man. I think he was English and he looks to be 20 or 21, and all it said really was missing in Cambodia. Please contact these people if you've seen this person. And it really sort of struck me. I mean, imagine that situation. What really could you do?
Yeah, really awful. Do you know anything more about that case? Do you know how long he was missing for or if he was found?
No, I don't actually. It was just sort of a passing thing that I glimpsed out of the corner of my eye. And I remember the photo, a very sort of young, good-looking guy standing on a beach somewhere. And it sort of looks like it has been very recently taken in happier times. And, I don't know, the face stuck in my head somehow. But no resolution as far as I know.
Yeah.
So
how did you find writing the book? Have you done a lot of writing before this?
Yeah, of course. Writing is something that's sort of my passion and my purpose in life. Writing the book was an interesting experience. I mean, stretched over about, I'd say, 4 or 5 years. I found that once the narrative got going and I brought the protagonist to life, it's written in the first person, in the past tense. Once I brought Hugh to life in my head, I sort of found that it wrote itself in many ways. Once he'd come to life, he sort of made his own decisions, and I'd given him the environment and the situation and the problem that he had to solve, and the narrative just kind of resolved itself and picked up its own momentum in short order.
So how long were you working on the book for?
I'd say from idea to publication, it was a period of about 5 or 6 years. So it's a significant period, but I think it needed to be spent.
And how did you feel once the book was out?
Oh, well, it's a sensation of great relief, I suppose. It's an interesting feeling. The thing about writing, especially when you're starting out in those early years, is that you spend a lot of time operating in the dark, I suppose, without any encouragement. And you just sort of have to keep believing in it yourself for a very, very long time, actually. And to get it recognised, it's really nice. It's a little bit unusual in some ways. But, yeah, it's a big relief and a great pleasure to have it published and have people reading it.
And does it feel weird kind of saying goodbye to the characters?
It did. Yeah, it does feel a little bit weird saying goodbye to the characters. I would say that having Hugh Fitzgerald, the protagonist, living inside my head, I wouldn't describe that as a particularly comfortable companionship. He's obviously a very dysfunctional, traumatized character, and he was with me for a long time. And it is actually, I think, it's good to say goodbye to him, because he was heavy to carry around in my head for such a long time.
Yeah.
In some ways.
Is it difficult sometimes to switch off from writing and immerse yourself in normal life?
Yes, it can be. The thing about writing and having a novel is that you sort of drag it around with you everywhere in some ways. It's always sort of on your mind, and the day, no matter how busy or full it is never really over unless you've opened up the book and spent a little bit of time with it. So it can be a little bit difficult to switch off from writing. It's a big obligation, I think. And very, very time-consuming and can sap your energy a little bit, but it's something that really must be done.
Yeah. I suppose that you never kind of get to the end of the day thinking, OK, I've done everything I can today. You can always do more.
Yeah, in a sense. I mean, With writing, what I always promise myself is the very least what I'll do is I will sit down in front of it, you know, and make myself a coffee and have a read through what I wrote last time and see if anything else comes out. And 9 times out of 10 when I do that, it turns into a good writing session. Occasionally it doesn't. I try not to beat myself up too much if it doesn't produce something spectacular, but really the important thing is just turning up to work, I feel.
Yeah. Well, is there going to be more from you? Is this the first of many, do you think?
Yeah, well, I certainly hope so. I'm deep into my next project. I can't really put a timeline on it, but it's definitely in the pipeline. It's going to be something new, something very different. A few people have asked me if I'm planning to produce a sequel. That's not really on the books, I would say, so to speak. There's another novel coming, certainly.
Great. Well, in the meantime, people can get a copy of Jack Was Here from our bookshop section on our website, tre.radio. It's by Christopher Bardsley, who we've been chatting to. Christopher, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Hannah.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Ali Carter, who was born in Scotland and read art history at St Andrews. There followed an eclectic career in investment management, retail and technology. Then in 2011, she had a catastrophic bicycling accident, and after major brain surgery and a long recovery, Ali set herself a challenge to walk alone from Canterbury to Rome, a 3-month pilgrimage she wrote about in her book An Accidental Jubilee. From then, she decided to follow her passion and become a fine artist, specialising in oil paintings from life with an emphasis on colour. But she's with us on the book show to talk about her debut novel, A Brush with Death, and it's described as Agatha Christie meets Downton Abbey. Welcome to the book show, Ali.
Thank you so much.
A pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us. So much I want to ask you. Can we start with your pilgrimage? What an amazing thing to take on.
Yes, it was. I think the key thing was not to think about the huge amount of length, you know, just take each day as it came. Because if you imagine 3 months of walking, it sounds rather exhausting.
So was it rather exhausting?
Yeah, it certainly was. People say that when you arrive in Rome, you got so used to walking, you just want to carry on. Whereas when I arrived in Rome, I was absolutely definitely ready to stop. With very sore feet.
Oh, I can imagine. And doing it all on your own, how did you find that?
I think if you're on your own, you have the opportunity to interact with strangers in a way that if you were with a friend, you wouldn't. And also, it gave me a lot of time to think. And I realised to think clearly takes a very long time, so that gave me an opportunity to really think things through. Of course, I did get lonely, but I learned a good skill of sort of picking myself up out of loneliness.
Yeah.
It's so useful in life.
And you felt it really benefited you then?
Oh, hugely. I mean, I sort of made promises to myself that when I'm now struggling with art, I think, well, I walked to Rome, you know, I must carry on, because you do eventually get somewhere if you keep aiming for your goal.
Yes. So where did the inspiration for this novel come from?
Well, I owe it all to my editor, Jenny Parrott, at One World. She heard me having a conversation in a pub in Soho with another woman about my art, and this woman commissioned me to draw her husband's dog. And Jenny was listening into our conversation and got very overexcited about the idea of a crime series involving pets and murder. She said, people love pets, they love murder. I'm an artist who draws pets. I mainly paint pictures, but I draw pets to earn money on the side. And I thought, let's have a shot as an artist who draws pets, has a keen eye for detail. She would double up nicely as an amateur sleuth. So I went away, wrote a few chapters, and it went on from there.
Fantastic. So this literally came from a chance meeting with an editor in a pub. That's amazing.
I know, isn't it? I mean, I'm so lucky.
So tell us a bit more about this character then. Susie is her name.
So she's called Susie Marl. People often ask why the surname Marl. When you paint, you have an instrument called a Marl stick, which keeps your hand steady when you paint. So I thought it was quite fun to have a reference to a steady hand.
Mm.
And it's written in the first person, and Susie is a single girl in her 30s who paints and draws pets
to earn a bit of extra cash. So people make the mistake of thinking, you know, this is me, but I constantly assure them it's a novel.
Not based on you at all?
Not based on me at all.
So where does the murder side come into the book?
The main focus of the book is to have a good look and laugh at the British class system. Two things. One, being an artist, you're very observant. Two, Susie is commissioned by a grand family to draw their dog. She becomes good friends with them, and then they, you know, by word of mouth, suggest her as an artist to some other people in the village. And so, I can't give away the story, but basically a murder happens, and then it sort of looks into when a murder happens in a grand family, how the sort of estates passed on, and all the intricacies of people who have land and money.
So did you need to do quite a lot of research into that then?
Yeah, I certainly did. There was a very nice man who is a barrister, and he was happy to give me you know, free advice and talk me through it. So I learned a lot.
And is there going to be more in this series, do you think? Are you keeping the character of Susie alive?
Oh, yes. I've written a second book, and it's busy being edited at the minute. Then I am putting together the third book. So I got a contract for three books, and the main character, Susie, and her love interest go through all three books.
Fantastic. So was it difficult to come up with other scenarios that would happen in the other books, or did it flow quite naturally?
Well, I've really enjoyed writing and coming up with stories, and as you might have gathered by walking to Rome, I love walking, and I find it a very good way. I go for a long walk, and I think up these sort of hopefully humorous stories, and then the hard work is writing them down and then hoping other people will enjoy them.
Yeah, well, it sounds like it's going well so far, so that's good. Do you mind if I ask you about your bicycling accident? Because it was obviously very serious to have major brain surgery. What happened?
So difficult to know what happened. I mean, people always say, were you hit? You know, how did you come off your bike? And I have no memory of it, but I definitely came off a bicycle and hit my head. But I didn't show any signs of having come off a bicycle and hit my head. And what happened is that I developed a blood clot between my brain and my skull. And I was insistent to the doctor that I don't normally complain and I'm sure there's something wrong with my head. And after 9 hours, they thought, well, let's give her a scan. And I'd had severe bleeding. And so then it was an emergency case. And I had a very long operation and was very, very lucky. Your brain is smaller than your skull, and mine helpfully moved to the other side while they were operating. So I wasn't brain damaged.
Gosh, that's amazing. Wow. Yeah. So your book, A Brush with Death, has certain connections to what actually happened with you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Oh. Well, it's great that you're still with us writing books. And if people want to get a copy of your first book, it's called A Brush with Death, A Susie Merle Mystery. And it's by Ali Carter, who we've been chatting to today. Ali, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
TRE.
Talk Radio Europe.
TRE. TRE. TRE.